Okay, I'll go ahead and call this meeting of the House Finance Committee to order. Let the record reflect that the time is currently 1:36 p.m. on Monday, March 9th, 2026. Present today, we have Representative Bynum, Co-Chair Shragi, Co-Chair Josephson, Representative Galvin, Representative Tomaszewski, Representative Hannon, myself, Co-Chair Foster. And just a reminder, folks can mute their cell phones. And we have two items on the agenda today. The first is going to be Senate Bill 64. That is the elections bill. And we'll continue with the subcommittee closeouts after we roll out a CS for the elections bill. We heard Senate Bill 64 previously. We reviewed the fiscal notes. We've taken public testimony on that bill. That's the elections bill. If it's the will of the committee, we will adopt a CS. We'll, of course, hear what that is. And then we'll go to questions and we'll set the bill aside. And then after that, we'll hand the gavel over and begin our subcommittee closeouts, or I should say continue on with that after we had some closeouts this morning. So with that, just so that we've got a new CS before us and have something to discuss, if I could entertain a motion, Representative Co-Chair Shragi.
Thank you, Co-Chair Foster. I move that the House Finance Committee adopt committee substitute for Senate Bill 64, Work Draft 34-LS0153-R, dated 3/6/26 as our working document.
Okay, and I'll object for the purposes of an explanation, and I would like to ask my staff, Mr. Brony Anderson, to please come up and put yourself on the record, and if you could explain the changes. And I'd also like to invite Mr. David Dunsmore to the table also to be available for questions. Let's see here. We also have Senator Wilikowski is in the audience and is available for questions as well. And so with that, if you could both please put yourselves on the record. Also, I'd like to note that we do have with us Representative Moore. And so welcome, gentlemen. Please begin.
Thank you for the record. Brody Anderson, staff to Representative Foster.
And David Dunsmore, staff to Senator Wilikowski.
I'll be walking through the committee through the CS changes. And the easiest way to do this from past experience will be for the members to have the two documents in front of you, one being the redlined version from U to R. And then also the bill in front, the actual R version of this bill. Starting, and I'll be walking through primarily using the red line as my source document, and then I'll be referring to where you can find it in the actual bill by line number, by page and line number. Starting on page 2 of the document, or of the red line, you can see it in lines 16 and 17. In your actual bill, it's going to be found on page 2, lines 16 and 17. Here on lines 16 and 17, you have the addition of except for when provided in the statute reference, and then the deletion of personal identifiable to confidential. This was a change for the use of what information will be provided by the Department of Revenue. Farther down, next couple lines down, on page 2, line 23 and 24, the change can be found in the bill on page 2, line 22. On line 24, they've added the words, during the previous year. This was a clarification on what information will be provided from the Department of Revenue for the permanent fund dividend application records, and it will be for only the previous year. Next.
Mr. Anderson, before you move on, if you could just explain why the change to line 16 and 17.
Through the chair, I would defer to Mr. Dunsmore for that.
Mr. Dunsmore, if you could put yourself on the record.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman. For the record, David Dunsmore again. This change was done to clarify that for people who are registering to vote through the PFD, that their names would still be available on the publicly available voter list that is available and personally identifiable. There was some worry that there was some ambiguity that that might include someone's name. At the request of the Division of Elections, this is just to clarify that for a registered voter, the information that would be available for any voter will be available, regardless of whether they register through the PFD or not, but that any of the confidential information that is being shared would not be.
Okay, thank you. Please continue, Mr. Anderson.
Thank you, Co-Chair Foster. The next change will be found on page 5 of your redline version. In the bill, it'll be found on page 5, line 15. On line 16 of your red line, you will notice that the words, "to the extent possible," has been added. This is in referencing the review of voter registration records and the updating of the master registry. This clarifies that when to the extent possible, that Department of Election or Division of Elections work with these other agencies that you see listed below, United States Postal Service, Systematic Alien Verification for Entitlement Programs, and other agencies, that they should work with these to the best extent possible when reviewing the voter registrations and master registry.
Okay. Question. Representative Josephson.
I think for Mr. Dunsmore, if I might. Mr. Dunsmore, to the extent possible, I'm trying to think what that adds to the language here. I mean, it suggests that if a complainant said, for example, the division didn't thoroughly use the Systematic Alien Verification for Entitlements Program system to verify citizenship, for example, the division could say, we ran out of time, and therefore we did it to the extent possible. I can't see how this changes.
Mr. Dunsmore?
Much.
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, this language was clarifying language that the Division of Elections had raised concerns that some of these data, like, for example, property and sales tax records, jury duty records, aren't going to be available for all 50 states. And they did not want in law a requirement that they access data that isn't necessarily going to be available. So the clarification is just if it's not possible, then they obviously don't have to consult those data sources.
Follow up. And I assume that's partly because there's a ticking clock. There's an election coming always. And if it's not possible, we still have an election obligation and a calendar to meet. Is that part of what's going on here?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, yes, that would be a consideration there. I would note this subsection has to do with the records that will be consulted as part of the voter roll cleanup statutes, which the operative part about who will be sent notices, I believe, is going to be subsection A of that statute. And that's required to happen in January of every year. And this subsection is adding in statute a list of data sources to be consulted during the review of the register that will result in the cleanup notices.
Follow?
Has the state, I see here it's been amended by adding new subsections, so it's new. And so my question with that preface is, has the state ever linked itself, its screening of someone's eligibility to a federal database that is meant to define whether someone's a citizen?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, I believe the answer to that question is no. I would note this subsection is data sources that will be consulted in the process, but it doesn't
It doesn't by itself. The categories for what would trigger a voter roll cleanup notice are going to be found in Section 4 of the bill. And if a voter does not meet the criteria that would be listed in Section 4, they wouldn't be sent a notice. For, I believe, specifically, you're referencing the systematic alien verification for entitlement. That one merely having a negative query that database isn't able to confirm a voter would not result in someone being taken off the rolls. But if, for example, a query of that database turned up that the Social Security Administration had a voter listed as dead, the Division of Elections might be able to track down a death certificate and remove a voter for that. But merely having a query result from that database would not affect a voter's status.
Last follow-up.
Representative Josephson.
Mr. Dunsmore, in a recent Alaska Beacon article, my recollection of what happened in Missouri and Texas was not just a query, but the division there itself removed individuals. In other words, there was no curative process. Maybe I'm being unfair to the article. I think that it was the first action was to remove, and perhaps there was a remedy that came after that. But you're saying in Alaska that would not be the first administrative action to simply disenroll someone.
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, that is correct. This wouldn't change any of the grounds for either removing a voter from the register or initiating the voter roll cleanup. That would be still regulated by the subsection A as well as the Federal National Voter Registration Act. Things like a voter being a voter dying or a voter voting in another state or a voter being convicted of a felony of moral turpitude are something that are allowable for a removal under current law. Other activities which we're expanding the list of to include more indicia of residency in another state would trigger a notification under Alaska law and the National Voter Registration Act. Where the voter would have the opportunity to confirm that they wish to remain a registered Alaska voter. But this subsection does not change. I've read about the Texas situation, and this bill would not authorize that.
Thank you.
Representative Bynum.
Thank you, Co-Chair Foster, and through the chair. Just to follow up on what Co-Chair Josephson was asking for page 5, line 16, the term "to the extent possible." I can read that, and obviously it seems pretty straightforward to me. There was a comment made that said that this was being added because the department wanted clarity. Has there been any kind of legal evaluation done on what the actual effect of law would be other than, I guess that's the question, has there been any evaluation done on effective actual law, as opposed to just this being a statute?
Mr. Dunsmore?
Through the chair, Representative Bynum, we have not requested a review other than in getting this version of the bill drafted, we told legislative legal the policy reasons for the language, and this is how they wrote it.
Okay. Follow-up?
Thank you. Chair Foster, is it possible that we could get that request that they would just do a quick review of that and provide that to the committee at a later time?
Mr. Brody Anderson or Dunsmore, if one of you could do that.
Through the chair, I will make the official request through our legislative legal.
Thank you.
Okay. Please proceed, Mr. Anderson.
Turning to the next page of your red line, on page 6, line 1, it kind of jumps from the line 31 of page 5. It says, by April 1st, from deleting February of each year. This is for the reporting described for the recent audit. That date has been changed to April 1st rather than February 1st. and that can be found on page 5, line 30 in the actual bill.
Representative Bynum.
Thank you, Chair Foster. Through the chair, is it possible that we could just get a brief explanation on the change of date?
Mr. Dinsmore.
Through the chair, Representative Bynum, this is a report that this bill would require the Division of Elections to hire an outside subject matter expert to audit the division's voter roll cleanup processes and provide this report to the legislature. The concern Division of Election raised was, since this voter roll cleanup process happens in January, that February was too quick of a turnaround. Working out what the appropriate time is, we settled on April because that would, if there were recommendations in the report that would prompt legislative action, there would be over a month of legislative time available for the legislature to consider it.
Thank you.
Okay. Please proceed, Mr. Anderson.
A little bit further down on this page, on page 6, starting at line 17, you'll see a conforming change, which will be followed up on the bottom of the page. The first, on line 17, it's adding a new subsections instead of a single section. That is because on line 27 through 30 of the red line, which can be found in the bill on page 6, line 25 through 28, we have the inclusion of a clause that says that the Division of Elections may delay a publishing of a data breach if law enforcement agencies have informed the director that the disclosure could possibly impede in an investigation. Moving on to page 8 of your red line, starting at line 21, going all the way down to 27, you will start to see technical forming, some technical changes along the way that I won't address, but this is one that, starting on line 21 of page 8, found in the bill, page 8, line 20 through 24, this section changes the definition of what can be accepted as proof of identification for voter registration cards. It deletes current utility bills, bank statements, paycheck, government checks, and reduces the definition of what will be acceptable material for that voter registration proof of identity.
Representative Josephson?
Yes, I think for Mr. Dunsmore, I mean, I notice the deletion of the hunting or fishing license. Wouldn't those be obtainable only by presenting other valid ID and making them de facto valid?
Mr. Dunsmore?
Or prima facie valid?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, I suppose to the extent that a hunting or fishing license would be considered a state identification card, they would still be covered under that. The concern that was brought forward with this to prompt this amendment was the fact that hunting fishing licenses can often be issued not by government agencies, but can often be, you know, a form you fill out at a private business, and that was the concern, was to limit it to documents you actually got from a government agency.
Okay, thank you.
Please proceed.
Before moving on from this topic, you will also see this same sort of change in acceptable material found in section 18 later in the bill on page 10, but the argument will be similar to why the definition of acceptable material has changed. Moving on page 10 of your red line, starting on line 3 and 4, you can find this change on page 9, line 31 of the actual R version of the bill. Here you see some deletion and then reaffirming blanks for attesting official or witness. This is to make sure that this was added as clarifying language to make sure that the witness signature is still on the envelope. So that was something that was asked for more additional clarification and conforming language.
I'd also like to note we also have with us Representative Jimmy. Welcome. Mr. Anderson.
Thank you. Moving down staying on page 10, going down to lines 19 through 25. This is that section 18 that I was referring to on the identification, the documents that would be accepted for recognizing approvable documents to prove in voter registration. Moving on. The next, on page 12 of your red line, coming down to line 16 and 17 of the red line, this can be found on page 12, lines 11 and 12 in the R version of the bill. Here you have voter is missing add voter's signature or the signature of an attested official or witness. This is clarifying language to make sure that the ballots may be cured if still missing the witness signature. A little bit farther down on lines 26 through 27 on the bill, it can be found on page 12, lines 21 through 22. This is clarifying language to make sure that mail that goes out actually goes to the mailing address and not any other address that might be listed on the form.
Question?
Yeah, Representative Josephson.
Through this chair to Mr. Dunsmore, does this relate to a disputed ballot involving an attorney, I think, in Fairbanks, where he claimed he didn't get his ballot because the PFD application used a different address than he was visiting or something along those lines? Is this designed to establish that there can be no address other than the mailing address, regardless of what a PFD application might say?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, no, this is simply clarifying for, as part of the cure process, when the Division of Elections reviews a ballot and identifies a deficiency that is curable, they are required within 24 hours to mail the voter a notice. And this is to clarify that for many voters, like, for example, I have a separate mailing address at a P.O. box is listed. And so Division of Elections both has my residence address and my mailing address. This would clarify that they're to mail it to the voter's mailing address if it's separate from their residence address.
Okay. Thank you.
Please proceed.
Moving on to page 13 of your red line. From starting at line 17 and going all the way through to page 14's lines 1 and 2, there is a deletion of an entire section of this bill, which is the procedures for the recount related to, so this is related to the counting of the ballots during a recount. This whole section here has been removed from the bill.
And if you could explain, maybe, Mr. Dunsmore, what exactly that means. It was added in here for a reason, but now we're removing it.
Mr. Chairman, this provision originated in a governor's bill. The Division of Elections was seeking to clarify that it's currently in statute a requirement that ballots that arrive after the deadline be counted in a recount. The reason we're proposing to remove it in the CS is that a legislator raised concerns that merely repealing that section of statute left ambiguity as to what ballots are to be counted in a recount and felt that it was better to leave in law guidance as to which ballots are counted in a recount.
Okay.
If I could.
Representative Josephson.
Mr. Dunsmore, There's nothing in this bill that changes the... I know there's a 15-day window for out-of-nation ballots. All of those rules remain the same for absentee ballots outside Alaska, essentially outside Alaska.
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, there is a provision in this bill that, you're correct, currently there is a deadline of 10 days after the election for ballots to arrive within the from being mailed domestically and 15 for ballots arriving from outside of the United States. There is a provision in this bill, I don't remember which section off the top of my head, that would say 10 days for all ballots. So this would allow elections to be certified 5 days faster. Okay. And past history, there's very few ballots that arrive in that 10 to 15 day window that are valid because they would have to have been postmarked by election day.
Yeah, if you're in rural Nepal in the Peace Corps, maybe your vote doesn't count, or you've got to vote faster, I guess. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Representative Hannon.
Thank you, Chair Foster. On that same point, yeah, I want to understand, we are saying they're not, that 10 to 15 day window aren't going to be counted at a recount, but they are still considered valid ballots, or are we shortening that return deadline somewhere for international ballots arrival? Are we shortening it to 10 days?
Mr. Densmore.
Through the chair, Representative Hannon, yes, this bill would shorten that, would establish a uniform deadline for 10 days for all ballots.
For all absentee.
Okay. Mr. Anderson.
Moving on to page 17 of your red line. Starting at line line 3 and 4, these changes will be found on page 16, line 15 and 16 of the actual R version of the bill. And also include line 5 of your red line. Changing the report deadline for the report that goes to the legislature from November 1st, 2026 to the first day of regular session. That first day of regular session, many of you that get those reports that come on that first day, this is more in line with that deadline. And the change of that November 1st, that is right at or before the election times. So the fact that a report is supposed to be created for reporting to the legislature, this gives them more time to compile data before the report is written and delivered. Moving on to page 17, down at the bottom there, I will talk about lines 18 through 31 together. You have, because of that previous section, this deals with the applicability clauses, because section 25 of the U version of the bill was deleted, you have a new section being added, rewritten to reflect that deletion of that section now. So it's major conforming language, but it can look confusing in both the red line. It can be found on page 16, line 25 through 31 of the R version of the bill. Basically, it's accounting for the deletion of that section, but all other sections are still apply. Mr. Chairman, besides more smaller conforming and technical changes done because of the changes of this bill, that concludes the changes made to version R.
Okay, thank you. Do we have any questions before I remove my objection for the adoption of the CS2? Do we have any other questions regarding this proposed CS? Representative Jimmy?
Thank you, Co-Chair Foster. My question is, say, systematic alien verification for entitlements is now being operated with involvement from Peltier and private tech companies with deep ties to DOGE. When Alaskans send voter data to SAVE, the data enters a private contractor can access. Has anyone gotten a written answer confirming whether Peltier can see the voter information Alaska sends to this system?
Mr. Densmore.
Through the chair, Representative Jimmy, yes, we've been researching the privacy concerns regarding that database. It's the intention with putting it in the bill was that it would be, our understanding was it would be a queryable database the state could use, but there have been concerns that using the database might require the state sharing sensitive information on voters. And, you know, we're definitely researching that and open to working with the committee for make sure that we're not compromising Alaskans' personal information.
Follow up. Thank you, Co-Chair Foster. So SAVE keeps the records for every query for 10 years. Every time we check a voter through the system, the federal government logs it and holds it for a decade. What exactly does the federal government keep when Alaska queries SAVE about one of our voters, and what are they allowed to do with it?
Mr. Densmore?
Through the chair, Representative Jimmy, my understanding is to query the database, they would need a voter's name, their date of birth, and their social security number, so that would be the input into the query. For a lot of voters, possibly the vast majority of voters, they wouldn't be able to query them because the Division of Elections probably doesn't have a social security number for most voters in the database. Yeah, as far as what the federal government is retaining and how, I think it's not entirely clear how much information is being retained. The agency that runs that database is Citizens and Immigration Services, which is the agency that is responsible for processing citizenship naturalizations, but they've had this expanded role with this database, and we're not entirely sure how much of the query data they're holding on to.
Thank you.
Okay, do we have any further questions? Seeing none, my intent is to remove my objection, and assuming there are no further objections, this is the new version that will be before us, and then we'll move over to just the closeout, the subcommittee closeouts, with maybe sending an amendment deadline. So hearing no further questions, I'm going to remove my objection. Are there any further objections? Seeing none, the version U or R is the version that will be before the committee. And what we intended, and correct me if I'm wrong, Mr. Anderson, is we want to set the bill aside. We want to give folks plenty of time to work on amendments. And so we're looking at some amendments earlier this week, but I wanted to push it back to make sure that folks had enough time. So we're thinking an amendment deadline of Friday, March 13th at 5 p.m. Is that, do I have that correct? And if folks could please provide those amendments to Mr. Anderson or Ms. Helen Phillips, our clerk, finance clerk. And so if there are no further things to bring before us on the bill, I'm going to take it at ease, hand the gavel over. So House Finance, brief at ease.
All right. We'll now continue to hear House Finance Subcommittee closeout reports. For the record, it is 2:11 p.m. Monday, March 9th in the Al Adams Room. We just set aside Senate Bill 64. We're going to finish or continue at least closeout reports from the subcommittees. Being presented this afternoon are the DMVA, Military and Veterans Affairs Subcommittee Report, Department of Labor and Workforce Development Report, Department of Natural Resources Report, Alaska Court System, Department of Public Safety Report, Department of Fish and Game Report, and the Department of Education and Early Development Report. We're going to do as many of these as we can anyway. For everyone's awareness, we are going to move the Department of Education and Early Development closeout report to after the DNR report. Mine is not to ask why. Mr. Brody Anderson, please come forward, put yourself on the record, and begin your closeout report for the Department of Military and Veterans Affairs.
I feel like I was just here. For the record, Brody Anderson, staff to Representative Neil Foster. Today I'm before the committee to present the budget closeout document, known as the narrative, to the committee. The Subcommittee of Military and Veterans Affairs had two meetings and closed out last Thursday. I will be referencing the narrative in your documents. The subcommittee closed out with unrestricted general funds of $18,554,400 of UGF, designated general funds or DGF, $1,100. In other funds, $14,812,500, and in federal funds, $36,379,800, for a total budget of $69,747,800. This closeout unrestricted general funds of $29,000. Above adjusted base, which is approximately 0.2% above adjusted base. In that department, for positions, there are 286 permanent full-time positions. There are no permanent part-time positions, and there are three temporary positions for a total of 286 positions total for the department. The subcommittee had five transactions that they dealt with in that subcommittee. The first one was accepting two positions in the office of the commissioner, which is adding two program managers for public protection and infrastructure support. Both of those were paid for by the federal receipts, which is $318,600 of federal receipt authority, but it does make two permanent full-time positions going forward. They approved two information technology classification study implementation transaction. The total was for $49,000 in the office of the commissioner. Of that $49,000, $16,300 of that was general funds. The rest is in federal and other receipt authority. The other implementation of the IT classification study was for $25,500 in Homeland Security and Emergency Management. 12.7 of that was unrestricted general funds, and the rest would be CIP or Capital Improvement Receipt Authority. We also accepted the department's transactions for the Army Guard facilities maintenance by adding two environmental program specialists for hazardous waste and water resource management. That is a total cost of $252,200 of federal receipt authority, and it adds two full-time positions. The final approval was a decrement of $27,400 of designated general funds in the Army Guard facilities maintenance due to uncollected rental fees. Mr. Co-Chair, that summarizes the closeout of the Department of Military and Veterans Affairs.
Okay. Thank you. Questions for Mr. Anderson about DMVA? Representative Tomaszewski.
Thank you, Co-Chair Josephson, through the chair. Talk to me about uncollected rental fees. What is that all about?
Mr. Anderson.
Thank you, through the chair. Representative, basically, due to the decrease of rentals in armories, particularly those that are out in remote locations where you have no armory attendants, the department was able to reduce that authority because they are either not in use or not being utilized. So through that non-use, they were able to lower their rental fees.
Thank you. Okay. Further questions for Mr. Anderson? Seeing none, thank you, Mr. Anderson, for your report. Next up is the Department of Labor and Workforce Development closeout report. Ms. Caroline Hamp. See her. She can come forward, put yourself on the record, and begin your report. Welcome.
Thank you. For the record, I'm Caroline Hamp, staff to Representative Schrage, here to provide information on the narrative report for the Department of Labor and Workforce Development House Finance Subcommittee. For the Department of Labor and Workforce Development Subcommittee Fiscal Year 2027 budget, the subcommittee recommends a total budget of $167,174,200. Of that, the unrestricted general funds are $23,364,700. Compared to the House Committee Substitute Number 1, the subcommittee recommendation represents a decrement of $534,000 or 2.2% in UGF, a decrement of $5,724,300 or 16.6% in DGF, a decrement of $1,453,800 or 7.8% in other funds, and a decrement of $2,591,800 or 2.6% in federal funds. The subcommittee adopted all governor proposed budget changes. However, two member amendments requested fund source changes that were adopted. One of those was a fund source change for the workers' compensation increment. The department had requested a one-time increment of UGF to maintain the workers' compensation operations because the Workers' Safety and Compensation Administration account, also known as WSCA, is currently underfunded due to decrease in revenue derived from employer-paid insurance premiums and a lack of reverse sweep. So there has been no carry-forward funding. However, a member amendment that was voted and adopted changed that UGF increase to timber sale receipts. So that is $1,405,000 in timber sale receipts instead of UGF. A secondary amendment was instead of funding Office of Citizenship Assistance through UGF and its associated three positions, it is to now fully fund it through STEP funds. And that's for a total of $478,900. Some of the other adoptions of the committee were technical transaction correction from LFD and a transfer of STEP, State Training and Employment Program, from the numbers section to the language section. So that's a huge reason why there's such a large decrement seen in those numbers, is because the STEP program was moved from numbers to language. And additionally, there were a deletion of two positions within the commissioner's office.
Representative Hannon for Ms. Stamp.
Thank you, Chair Josephson. Ms. Stamp, first I'm going to start on the workers' compensation one. So help me understand how we can take money from a different department's receipts to fund something, the workers' comp, that we are legally obligated to have. So, for instance, what if there isn't timber receipts totaling that amount, if there isn't a timber sale?
Ms. Stamp.
Thank you. For the record, Caroline Hamp.
I apologize.
That's okay. Through the chair to Representative Hannon. The timber sale receipt is it is able to be used for any public fund source, as noted by the committee member who offered this amendment. That member also did work with LFD and OMB to make sure that there are currently enough funds in the timber sale receipts to fund this item.
Follow-up.
My
presumption is that the Department of Natural Resources, thank you, through Chair Josephson, would generally be using the timber sales receipts. I haven't served on the DNR subcommittee for a few years, but I did my first two terms, and that was usually rolled over to the functioning of the Division of Forestry. So does this require a decrement in the DNR budget for otherwise timber receipt usage that they had planned, or is this deemed an excess amount that was going to be swept?
Ms. Hamp.
Through the chair, Representative Hannon, there is enough in this year's account, and because it's a one-time increment, there is enough both between the DNR current budget and this one-time increment.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, I have one other set of questions that I wanted to ask.
Please,
about.
Please continue. Representative Hannon for Ms. Hamp.
And I'm looking for it. I had it a second ago. The position deletions in the commissioner's office.
Hemp, it helps through the chair. It is number 4 on the BA report.
Thank you. And I, Ms. Hemp, through the chair, we both, it looks like from this BA, both the $84,000 of UGF that was used to fund part of two positions is being deleted, but the bulk of those two positions is funded through interagency receipts, $343,000. And the subcommittee chose to both take the UGF increment and delete the positions. Is that accurate?
Ms. Hamp.
Through the chair, yes, that is correct.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, just so you know, and I've talked to the subcommittee chair, I will be seeking to give the department the authority to retain that position that is currently filled. So instead of laying off an employee who is the ledge liaison, and I don't know if you, your office, but certainly during the interim, one of the very common inquiries I get is from someone who wants to talk to the Department of Labor about unemployment complications. And so the ledge liaison at the Department of Labor is one of the ledge liaisons that during the interim I end up calling quite frequently. And I would really hate to see that position go away. It is my understanding that the department is willing to fund it internally. And as you can see from the interagency receipts, the bulk of that position is funded without UGF. But if we take the position as well as the funding, they can't do that. So I am hoping that we would at least restore the position and give them the ability to retain what I think is a pretty important service delivery for Alaskans, even if we're going to take $84,400 out of the general fund at the Department of Labor. So I just wanted to make sure I've started talking to my committee about that.
Representative Galvin.
Thank you, Co-Chair Josephson. Just hoping for a brief synopsis, if you could, around the decision-making to change the fund source from UGF to STEP funds for the Office of Citizenship Assistance. And does that, part two of the question is, does this make the funding for this program any less stable?
Ms. Hamp.
Through the chair, Representative Galvin, the committee discussed finding savings within UGF and decided that an amendment to put forward a fund source change would be a good way to keep the office while saving some UGF. I do not have an answer to your second question.
Follow-up. Rep. Galvin for Ms. Hamp.
Okay, maybe another way to ask is, does this decision have to be revisited every year in order to fund the U.S. Citizenship Office?
Ms. Hamm, we have lifelines here. If it's requested.
Through the chair, Representative Galvin, I believe, even with step funding, that the Office of Citizenship Assistance would and is in the base budget, and therefore it's not necessarily needing to be put in every year.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, any other questions on Department of Labor and Workforce Development? All right. Ms. Hamper, are you still with us, or...
Chair Josephson, yes. I think that's probably why you asked Deed to go a little bit later, so that I didn't have to play musical chairs.
Yes, yes. All right, so, Ms. Hamp, the DNR closeout report, please.
Thank you. Now we will move on to the Department of Natural Resources. Once again, for the record, Caroline Hamp, staff to Representative Shragi. The fiscal year 2027 budget for the Department of Natural Resources subcommittee recommends a total department budget of $212,189,000. Compared to the FY27 House Committee substitute number one, the subcommittee recommendations represent a decrease of $272,500 in UGF, an increase of $3,896,500 in DGF, an increase in $1,355,200 in other funds, and an increase of $7,609,900 in federal funds. Compared to the FY27 Governor amended budget, the subcommittee recommendations represent a decrease of $1,960,500 in UGF. The subcommittee adopted all of the governor's proposed budget requests, except for the changes to create the Department of Agriculture. That included denying a structure change in two increments, totaling $301,100 of various sources. The subcommittee's recommendation instead is to keep the Division of Agriculture based within DNR. Additionally, the subcommittee adopted a decrement of $641,100 UGF to delete four vacant forester positions located at Anchorage, Haines, and Ketchikan. Additionally, there was in FY25 a $900,000 fund source change from timber sale receipts to UGF to pay for forestry-related positions, and this subcommittee reversed that action, so now those UGF forestry-related positions are now funded through timber sale receipts. The subcommittee adopted the deletion of the recently vacated deputy commissioner position and added a one-time increment of $1,956,600 in vehicle rental tax to fund revenue-generating facilities and infrastructure projects within parks management and access.
Ms. Hamp, can you, as to the last bulleted point in the narrative, the vehicle rental tax, does that usage oversubscribe the vehicle rental tax, or is there adequate funds for it?
Through the chair, it would be over the amount that is typically allocated from that fund. So it would be over-appropriating the vehicle rental tax fund.
And does that mean it pays as far as it can go and then reaches a limit and doesn't pay more?
Through the chair, I would prefer a lifeline to dig into fund source if a legislative finance division member might. Nathan Teal is the DNR.
Okay. One of you gentlemen, please. Good afternoon.
Thank you. For the record, Alexi Payne, Legislative Finance Division. So the vehicle rental tax typically based on the statutory guidance, the legislature spends the actual receipts from the previous closed fiscal year, so we'd be spending the actual revenue collected in FY25. So this overspends what was actually collected in FY25. The account itself doesn't retain a balance from – it's really just a tracking code for a revenue amount. So structurally, if we overspend that amount, you're spending general funds because it's just a sub-account of the general fund and doesn't behave like a true fund, if that makes sense. So overspending is kind of – it's unclear what the true effect would be, but essentially would be spending general funds.
If in my hometown of Anchorage someone said, asked me, are we spending more on parks management and access and infrastructure projects, could I, if this survived in both the other chamber and this body and the governor's office, could I say, yes, we spent $1.95 million more? Would that be the answer? In all circumstances, where the governor approved it, the Senate approved it?
I mean, Mr. Chairman, for the record, Alexi Painter, this is just an odd instance where we call it designated general fund. There's not a fund. There's not an account. It rolls up to the general fund. When we've inadvertently over-appropriated by small amounts, they've just pulled that from the general fund. We've never intentionally over-appropriated by a significant amount. And I'm not quite sure how, like, the governor or Division of Finance would react to that situation if we intentionally overspent.
Okay. Representative Galvin.
Thank you, through the chair. Mr. Painter, I think this may be a question for you. And the vehicle rental tax, I understand that when it was originally put into place, there was discussion around it supporting a portion of it would – the portion, I believe, that reflected independent travelers – would be placed in something related to funding ATIA or something similar to that. Was that in statute or was that just in intent language?
Mr. Painter.
Through the chair, Representative Galvin, the statute for the vehicle rentals tax states that the entire fund or entire amount collected is designated for tourism marketing.
Okay, I have a different question on a whole different topic, so I'll wait until it's appropriate.
We'll come back. Representative Hannon.
Thank you, Chair Josephson. Mr. Painter, the chairman's original question to Ms. Hemp was, is this account, this fund, being over-appropriated? And the answer briefly was yes. Could you tell us by how much?
Mr. Painter.
Through the chair, Representative Hannon, by roughly the amount of this increment less, I think it was already slightly overspent by, like, you know, less than 50,000, so within kind of the margin of that we wouldn't worry about. So roughly by this amount, the 1.9 million.
Follow up, Representative Hannon.
And thank you, Chair Josephson. And Mr. Painter, that's accounting for, because I'm aware that the Department of Transportation has an appropriation for it, the DCCED, and then this appropriation. So that's in tallying all three attempts to tap that fund.
Mr. Painter.
Through the chair, Representative Hannon, yes.
Thank you.
All right. Representative Bynum on the VRT issue. Mm-hmm. Okay. Please proceed.
Thank you, Co-Chair Justice, and through the chair. Again, that item, just to clarify, that's 26 for 1.956 million vehicle rental tax. Do we know, and I don't, it's not going to obviously be here, but do we know, are we funding in the budget the marketing for tourism?
Through the chair, Mr. Bynum, no.
Yeah, okay. Mr. Chair, I think that's a bit concerning that we have a fund that is not dedicated, but may be used for the purpose in statute, and yet we continue to not fund it. So I think when we come back through the budgetary process, we're going to be stuck with this real conundrum, and that is to make sure that we're trying to fund a very important program with UGF dollars, or we're going to have to be shifting things around instead of using the tax revenues which are being put in place that are kind of intended for that purpose. So,
Mr. Painter, is ATIA sometimes funded in the capital budget and not the operating budget?
Mr. Chairman, more often than not, it has been in the capital budget. Occasionally, it has been the operating budget. In the governor's budget, it's in neither.
Okay. Mm-hmm. New question from Representative Galvin.
Oh, thank you, Co-Chair Josephson, through the chair. This question, and I'm not sure how to use the right terminology, but in the report, I heard mention of positions moving from UGF to DGF. And so this is a question for Mr. Painter, I believe. In a different committee, it was advised to me to not move from DGF to UGF for positions because it may not have fit code for accounting. And I just want to make sure of what that looks like for in this scenario.
Mr. Painter.
Through the chair, Representative Galvin. So in this case, the item in question is funding positions that relate to the collection of the receipts. So it's an appropriate use of that fund source. The rationale for the fund source change a couple of years ago that this is undoing was to free up timber sale receipts for capital projects. The governor has a capital project utilizing this fund source. So it was sort of to utilize unrestricted general funds to support the ongoing operations, and then because the timber sales are a little lumpy, to use those when they're available in the capital budget. That was the decision 2 years ago. This would go to, you know, using them in the operating budget more like we did prior to the budget 2 years ago.
Thank you. That clears it up a lot. Appreciate it.
Okay. Other questions on DNR? Representative Bynum.
Thank you, Co-Chair Josephson. Through the chair, just wanted to recap item number 12. This is the fire suppression, land water resources, forest management and development. This was the deleting of four vacancy forestry positions. I just wanted clarity on the need, whether there was a discussion on the need for those positions as far as functionality, and that they're just being deleted, and if they are just being deleted just for the purposes that they've been vacant. Can I get some clarity?
Yes, Ms. Hampe, do you know the answer?
Through the chair, Representative Bynum, partially a savings mechanism and because they're vacant, but there was also some good neighbor authority provided in this budget federal funding to help fund a forestry position in Ketchikan. So we were hoping that some of these things would be balanced out by upcoming increase in federal authority.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I don't see any other questions, so we will move on now to the Department of Education and Early Development. And that looks like Mr. Jang's turf. Mr. Jang, welcome. Please tell us about the deed closeout.
Good afternoon, members of the House Finance Committee. For the record, my name is David Jang, staff to Representative Elise Galvin. The House Finance Budget Subcommittee for the Department of Education Early Development submits the following recommended operating budget for FY27 to the House Finance Committee. The recommendations from the subcommittee by fund source are $105 million $18,700 in UGF, $38,364,600 in DGF, $38,416,300 in other funds, and $267,354,300 in federal receipts, for a total of $49,153,900 in all funds. Compared to the FY27 amended budget proposal, subcommittee recommendations increase UGF by $4,900,100, or a 4.9% increase in UGF funds, or 1.1% out of all funds. An important thing to note is that all the numbers previously mentioned, including this 4.9% increase, do not take into account public education funds that go directly to districts based on formula funding, base student allocation, or pupil transportation, since these are language items not in the purview of the subcommittee. Should these items be included, the $4.9 million increment aforementioned accounts for around 0.3% UGF increase. Should these be included? The number and type of positions in the subcommittee recommendations are the following, and you'll see this also on the first page in the bottom left corner. 280 permanent full-time positions, 10 permanent part-time positions, and 16 temporary positions for a total of 306 positions. The House Finance Budget Subcommittee for the Department of Education Early Development reviewed the FY27 budget requests and adopted all of the governor's requests, and the subcommittee put forth 7 additional items. I just want to put it on the record and make a correction that there were 15 governor's items accepted and 7 items put forth by the subcommittee. That makes 22 total items. Originally on this sheet, I made a typo, but that has been corrected in the versions now published. You can see going back to the report, you can see the governor's items in black text and items added by the subcommittee in blue. And I will highlight the major items here. Beginning on page 2, item 1 of the governor's request was accepted, which would add $771,200 in UGF for statutory funding for the new Lake and Peninsula School District Residential Program. Moving on to the subcommittee's changes, item 6 is a decrement of $450,000 UGF to the Student Information System and Predictive Data Dashboard. The original allocation for this item was $900,000 put into the base in the FY24 budget. This decrement would reduce funding for this item by half, and to date, $2.7 million has been spent on this dashboard, which, according to Deed, these funds are focused on establishing a foundational architecture for the project. The department has stated that this portion of the work did not produce a standalone deliverable and will not present anything tangible until later phases of the project. In the absence of a deliverable, this decrement would still allow for further development of the dashboard, as well as a recalibration of necessary funds to move this project to completion. Moving on, item 8, which you can find on page 3, is an increment of $450,000 UGF to teacher incentive payments and reimbursements for the national board certifications under Alaska Statute 14.20.225. No funding for this item was included in the FY25 budget, and funding was vetoed in the FY26 budget. Item 9 is an increment of $490,000 UGF for the Alaska Council of School Administrators contract for the Alaska Educator Retention and Recruitment Center, otherwise known as ARC. ARC serves as a direct recruitment and retention services hub to Alaska school districts, providing direct support, especially to the 573 international teachers on J-1 and H-1B visas, who alone serve 9,365 students. This increment will restore this funding and adjust for additional costs. Moving on, item 10 is an increment of $80,000 UGF to Best Beginnings Imagination Library. This program sends a children's book every month to families across the state, with Best Beginnings currently serving just under 16,000 Alaskan children in 138 communities. For the record, the current level of program funding is $320,000 UGF, and this increment merely serves to inflation-proof the current level of funding for additional costs of materials, that is, books and postage, and maintain the current level of service in the program of 28% of eligible children served in the state. Item 11 is an increment to 355,000 $800 UGF for Parents as Teachers, otherwise known as PAT program. This program delivers home visiting services to families from the prenatal period through early childhood, equipping new parents with the skills to take care of their child, often in remote areas of the state. The current level of funding for this program is $474,400, which serves 274 children across the state, and this increment is estimated to serve an additional 115 children, directly addressing wait lists for programs in communities across the state. Item 12 is an increment of $3,756,800 UGF to increase Head Start grants to provide grantees with a full amount of required non-federal matching funds. The federal government has allocated $67,181,300 for Head Start programs in Alaska. The state of Alaska must match 25% of this amount, according to both Alaska statute and the federal matching funds requirement, with an expected state share of $16,795,300. The current funding for Head Start is $13,038,500. This increment is the exact amount needed to bridge the gap and satisfy the non-federal match requirement. Item 19, which you can find on page 5, is an increment of $217,500 UGF for the statewide library electronic doorway, or also known as SLED. This item provides internet access to millions of journal articles, newspapers, and e-books, and as well as other educational resources for students, universities, libraries, and the general public. This increment maintains this current level of operation for this program and does not restore any programs that were previously terminated. In other words, this is the minimum level of funding required to maintain and sustain SLED operations in FY27. Now going back to governor's items that the subcommittee accepted, items 21 and 22, which you will find on the last page, addresses increases in funding to the Alaska Performance Scholarship, APS, and the Alaska Education Grants, AEG. Item 21 for APS is an increment of $3,293,800 from the Higher Education Investment Fund, or HIFE, to add funding for projected scholarship disbursement increases. Item 22 adjusts AEG funding accordingly as the two funds move in tandem, with AEG receiving 50% of the funding of APS. Thus, the associated increment for AEG is $1,646,900. That concludes my closeout report for the Department of Education Early Development, and I thank the committee for their time.
First, Representative Galvin, the committee co-chairs asked for a convincing case for increments, and I applaud you. In your hard work and your narrative for making that case, at least in this chair's view. Representative Hannon.
Thank you, Chair Josephson. Mr. Young, on items 21 and 22, we've heard about the HIFE fund needing to be recapitalized. What happens to those two increments if we don't recapitalize the HIFE funds?
Mr. Jang, if you know, and we have lifelines here.
Through the chair to Representative Hannon, I would like to call legislative fiscal analyst to answer this question, if I may.
You may indeed, and we have Mr. Bell joining us. Mr. Bell, welcome.
For the record, Connor Bell, fiscal analyst, Legislative Finance Division. The Higher Education Investment Fund is subject to appropriation, so regardless of whether the Higher Education Fund is recapitalized from the Constitutional Budget Reserve, there's sufficient funding for this year for these draws. It would just mean that there would continue to be an unsustainable draw rate based on projected market returns, so the fund would decrease over time.
Okay. Thank you.
Other questions? Seeing and hearing none, thank you, Mr. Bell. Thank you, Mr. Jang. That completes the deed closeout report. So we're going to move to another branch of government judiciary. Mr. Keenan Miller, please come forward, put yourself on the record, and begin your closeout report of the Alaska court system. It's Mr. Miller, right?
Yeah.
Mr. Miller, please put yourself on the record and give us your report on the judiciary's requests.
Wonderful. Thank you, Chair Josephson, Co-Chair Josephson, excuse me. Good afternoon, members of the House Finance Committee. My name is Keenan Miller. I am staff to Representative Jimmy. I'm going to keep things pretty short and sweet for you today and go through the governor's proposed budget, which was accepted with four changes that are reflected in your budget action reports. I will address items 2, 4, and 5, and then return to item 3. In item 2, the Finance Subcommittee added $600,300 in UGF for inflationary increases to lease, utility, and service payments. In item 4, the Finance Subcommittee added $115,500 in GF, Mental Health Receipt Authority, for a two-year increment supporting salary and benefit increases for two paralegals that do centralized competency calendar management for the judiciary. In item 5, $6,000 in UGF was added for the Commission on Judicial Conduct to conduct its fourth quarterly meeting in person. These three items just restore the judiciary's original fiscal year 2027 budget request. And then item 3 adds $363,500 in UGF to address increased court visitor caseload and backlog. The judiciary confirmed the need for additional funding because the need for court visitors remains elevated despite the exclusion of this line item in the fiscal year 2026 budget. Overall, these adjustments result in a net increase of $1,085,300 in UGF from the governor's proposal, which is equal to 0.7%. And I'm happy to answer any questions from the committee about these items.
Questions as to the court system closeout? Okay, that was short and sweet. Mr. Miller, stay with us, and we're going to take up the Department of Public Safety budget.
Alrighty, and again, for the record, my name is still Keenan Miller. I'm still a staff to Rep. Jimmy, last I checked. We'll see how this goes. Maybe that'll change after. The governor's proposed budget for the Department of Public Safety was accepted with three changes that are reflected in your budget action report. So if you flip to item 8, the Department of Public Safety Finance Subcommittee added $1 million and $200,000 in UGF to the Council on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault, or CDVSA. This is an increment that only begins to partially address inflationary pressures that have grown worse since 2017, which was their last increase. For your reference, today's dollar is worth about two-thirds of what it was back then. The money in this increment and for this purpose goes to direct grants to service providers of victims. And in the Finance Subcommittee, members heard that wages, for example, are not competitive for providers. It's hard to survive on passion alone when you're doing such heavy work. So this will be a step towards making sure that direct service providers have the supplies and the employees and what they need to adequately and effectively carry out this important victim support work. In item 9, $500,000 was added for legal services to survivors of domestic violence and sexual assault, also to the CDVSA. This replaces lost Federal Victims of Crime Act funding and supports the administration of low bono legal support to survivors. And then in items 10 and 11, these are related. We denied a decrement and replaced the Finance Subcommittee denied a decrement and replaced $592,000 in lost crime victim compensation funding with UGF dollars. This funding allows the department to provide financial assistance to victims of violent crime as a pair of last resort at similar rates as in the past, reimbursing eligible expenses that aren't otherwise covered by insurance or restitution or available resources. And state funds that are distributed to victims are reimbursed at 75 cents per dollar spent. And all these adjustments result in a net increase of $2,292,000 in UGF from the governor's proposal, or 0.8%. I'm again happy to answer any questions from the committee.
Okay. I don't see any, Mr. Miller. So we'll go to the final closeout of the afternoon, and that is the Department of Fish and Game.
All right. Thank you again, Representative, or Co-Chair Josephson. Again, for the record, my name is Keenan Miller. I'm staff to Representative Jimmy. There were several changes in the Department of Fish and Game made to the governor's proposed budget. They are reflected in your budget action reports. This is going to be a bit of a longer one. As you can see, I have two pages and not only one. So let's go ahead and go to item 7. What item 7 does in your BA report is adds $400,000 in UGF to supplant contributions made by the Bristol Bay Science and Research Institute to the Port Mahler test fishery. It added that to the Westward Region Fishery Management allocation. I wanted to note that Representative Jimmy has recommended on the Department of Fish and Game's advice that this actually be technically corrected and moved to the Central Region Fisheries Management allocation. The Port Mahler test fishery is used to generate estimates of sockeye salmon stock and age. It is deemed a core program that, by the Bristol Bay Fisheries Collaborative, of which the department is a part. And by supplanting the BBSRI funding contributions, that group can shift their funding focus to early stage Chinook salmon genetic projects to help us conserve those stocks. Moving on to item 10. Item 10 replaces $1,160,300 in CFEC receipt authority with UGF in the statewide fisheries management allocation. The Commercial Fishery Entry Commission has a projected negative carryforward balance. This is inappropriate from an accounting perspective, so this eliminates that. I'm going to go ahead and skip item 11 for you for just a minute. We'll come back to it, I promise. And items 12 through 14 give the Commercial Fisheries Entry Commission the CFEC receipt authority that is needed to fund three positions related to records reduction, Bristol Bay permitting, and IT modernization, restore the services budget for them to sustainable levels, and reclassify exempt IT positions. The sum of these increments is $532,900. Item 15 gives the CFEC received authority that is needed to fund its ongoing IT modernization project at a rate of $150,000 a year for three fiscal years. This is described by them as kind of a two-parter. Part of it is getting them onto and building up a new system. The other is trying to keep the old one alive long enough for them to make the transition. They shared with us that they're still on COBOL, which is a coding language that I had to look up because it is a quite old one. Now returning to item 11, this does the same thing that item 10 did. It replaces $682,800 in CFEC receipt authority with UGF in the statewide fisheries management allocation with a goal, once again, of eliminating CFEC receipt overdraw. And then item 18, if you'll follow me along to that, replaces $2,243,100 in UGF with federal receipt authority so that the Anchorage and Fairbanks hatcheries can leverage their in-kind contributions from construction costs as a match for use of Dingle Johnson funds. At the current rate of drawdown for this match for these hatcheries, the $78.8 million remaining in federal receipt balance will run out sometime around 2070. So this seemed an appropriate cost-saving measure to the subcommittee. In all, these adjustments match the UGF spend of the governor's proposed budget and add three temporary positions. And I am ready for any questions from the committee.
Just to clarify, Mr. Miller, in item 7, there could be an amendment to move that item to the central region from the westward region. Is that what you said?
Yes. Okay. The hope is that that can happen. It was an error on my part. I looked at the location of where the study was happening, but it turns out that due to a quirk in where the department runs this program, it was the wrong one. So,
Rep. Hannon for Mr. Miller.
Thank you, Chair Josephson. I'm going to start on the CFEC projected negative carry-forward balance, and I want to just affirm that that is from the current fiscal year that that negative balance is anticipated.
Mr. Miller.
You know, this is a question that I should probably call up a lifeline for if Legislative Finance Division is able to come up. But I believe that the answer is at the current rate of CFEC overdraw, they expect next year to be about 1.1, 1.2 million in the red, which would be unacceptable. So it's preventative.
Any additions or modifications to Mr. Miller's last comment about CFEC? Yes.
Okay.
No.
Another question on
yes.
CFEC.
Rep.
Can you tell me currently how many staff they have, not the temporary IT positions, but the commissioners and I think it's an executive director, and are all those positions currently full?
Mr. Miller.
You'll have to excuse me for a moment for the record, Keenan Miller. Let me see if I have the presentation up and I can provide that information to you. Unless Legislative Finance is the answer on the, off the top of their head. No? Okay.
The staffing level at the CFEC current positions, whether all the commissioner positions were full and the ED position full, or are there vacant positions at CFEC?
And I have the answer for you now.
Mr. Miller.
So through the chair, there are two vacant positions in the Commercial Fisheries Entry Commission organization chart as of February 2020. Oh, excuse me. There are five currently vacant as of February 2026. But to my understanding, the Commercial Fisheries Entry Commission has already folded these positions into their organization structure.
One more follow-up.
Yes.
I'm trying to understand how they are accruing a negative spend projection with such a high vacancy, because they only have like 7 or 8 positions total.
And
so if they've got 5 vacancies, how they're spending so much money.
The committee is not in a rush at the moment, so we have a moment or two to talk about this. Would Mr. Painter like to join in on this? Okay.
Through the chair to Representative
yes.
Hannon. The simple fact of the matter from the presentation given to us by the Commercial Fisheries Entry Commission. So the way their budget is structured, they take in CFEC receipt revenue. And the total amount of expenditures between the Commercial Fisheries Entry Commission and receipts being drawn upon by the Commercial Fisheries Division, as well as a small amount by the Fisherman Fund, is simply going to be more than they expect to take in. So the numbers on the total receipt revenue expected for the FY27 budget is $6,500,000. The total expected CFEC expenditures is about $4,023,000. The total amount of commercial fisheries expenditure is about $3,579,500. And the expected expenditures for the Fisherman Fund are $300,000, leaving the projected carry-forward balance again at negative $1,160,300.
And then one more.
Yeah, sure. Follow-up. Rep. Hannon for Mr. Miller.
Thank you, Chair Joseph. Did the subcommittee discuss at all eliminating any of the positions at CFEC from the vacant positions separate than the ads for IT modernization restructure, but the current positions where we have highly paid commissioners and whether any of those positions were discussed being eliminated.
Through the chair to Representative Hannon, no.
Okay. I think we've exhausted the questions. I'd like to thank Mr. Miller for his reports today. You were certainly nimble on your feet there, young man.
Thank you.
That concludes our business for today. Our next House Finance Committee meeting is scheduled for tomorrow, March 10th at 1:30. At that meeting, we will finish hearing House Finance Subcommittee closeout reports. Then, wait for it, this is good news here, we're again going to take up House Bill 280, apportionment of taxable income, digital business. So we're going to adjourn today's meeting at 3:06. We're adjourned.